Hey, good afternoon, everyone. AM 950, Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Doug Padgett. Brett, you might not remember, but years ago, I was on this radio station. I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, a Sunday morning show. And that was the theme song, and we're back in the flow.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like no time ever passed, right?
Well, but yeah, and that's, you know, when you're a middle-aged man, that's the scariest thing that could happen to you, is you realize I'm just doing the same thing, and I didn't even know any time had passed. So, hey, everyone, my name is Doug Padgett. And today, tomorrow, the next day, a couple of days next week, I'm filling in on Drive Time here on AM 950, the Progressive Voice in Minnesota. And I have a couple of guests with me today. I'm referring to this as Flashback Tuesday, partly because for me, it's a flashback from my AM 950 Sunday morning religious radio that's not quite right show. But also, we're going to be talking about something that happened in Minnesota a few years ago that a lot of people have forgotten about, and is really deeply connected to a number of the issues that are still happening in our world today. And, you know, I'm like a lot of people that listen to this station, I'm very concerned about the political state of our country. It seems to me that the president of the United States has diminished the role of the U.S. around the world. I care a lot about that. I care about the policies that go into it. I see the behavior of this country. And sometimes I look around and say to myself, I don't know what country I live in. That's a common feeling for a lot of us. And then we also realize that, boy, that's been going on for an awfully long time. There are a number of people who have felt that there's experiences in this country that make it feel unfamiliar. And we're going to talk a bit about that, this idea that the way our country behaves, the way that even the state of Minnesota has behaved, and I'm going to talk a bit more about this in a second, that the pride that a lot of us hold in Minnesota, the sense that we have about the state of Minnesota, is that these are good people in Minnesota. We tend to be progressively minded and open-hearted, that this is a state that takes in people from other countries. It's a kind place. And while that's true in some instances, it's not true all the time. And there's a storyline from 3 or 4 years ago in Minnesota that maybe some of you are remembering. And that's when a whole group of young Somali men were arrested, charged, and convicted on terrorism charges. It's something that maybe right now it's sort of coming back to you, that there was a period of time a few years ago when that was a big news story, and it was about young Somali men who were being recruited into ISIS, and there was a big trial. And it conjures up all kinds of topics of our day today. National security concerns, the FBI with informants, the FBI bringing big charges against someone so that they could get a conviction out of other people. All kinds of news items that some of us feel like are happening with the Trump administration today. And for me, as a progressively minded person, I feel pretty good about that when that's happening with the Trump side, actually. I will admit that I keep up on it every night, and I feel myself cheering on FBI investigations. But there's a storyline in Minnesota where some of us feel like, boy, those same practices of our government and the same practices of the FBI didn't turn out so well for some people. And we're going to talk about that today on this hour. So I have a couple of guests here in the studio with me. Matthew Palumbo, a friend and philosophy professor at Minneapolis Community and Technical College. And Burhan. Burhan, thank you for being here. Guys, remind me and the other listeners of all the details that went on with these young men being arrested, and repaint that story for us from 2013, 14, 15. What was going on? Give us the high-level introduction to what happened here in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Well, thanks, Doug. We'll talk more about the behind and the framework of this, but in April of 2015, five young Somali men, were arrested on April 19th and charged with conspiracy to materially support a terrorist organization, mm-hmm. namely ISIS. Overall, 10 young men were charged in that same period. After they were charged, most of them in April of 2015, many of the young men were forced to plead guilty. They were threatened with life in prison charges, and as a deal, took a plea agreement. In June, May and June of 2016, three of the young men went to trial and were convicted by an all-white jury in outstate Minnesota that convicted them for conspiracy to murder abroad, which is a life sentence.
Yeah, and that's a really serious charge.
It's a very serious charge.
And I remember
charge.
At the time people feeling like, man, I didn't know that young Somali men were being caught up in ISIS, and I'm glad we've been protected from all that. Like, that was the narrative in the news.
Right. Yep. And then in November of 16, 1 week after Trump was elected, all of these young men were sentenced. The young men that cooperated with the FBI got very little time, a few years. The young men that pled guilty got 10 years. And then the three young men who went to trial got 30, and Guled Omar got 35 years in federal prison and life probation. This coming Thursday in St. Paul is their appeal. The appeal is at the U.S. Court of Appeals in downtown St. Paul. Their oral arguments begin at 9 a.m. And for listeners, we are asking everybody who is a person of conscience that cares about the injustices around this to join us at 8 a.m. on the courthouse steps to be in solidarity with these young men and to say that the FBI tactics that were used to target them, to entrap them, to convict them are unjust practices and we believe out of line with basic moral principles of ethics and law. So that's this Thursday is their appeal, and that is very significant and why we're here today.
And that's this is a touchy subject, right? When you're asking people to say, hey, would you step out and speak about your government, speak about the FBI on behalf of people who are convicted of terrorism charges? Like, all of this is sort of embroiled with all the flash terms and all the words of concern: national security, ISIS, terrorism, the FBI, convictions. All of that creates a picture in a lot of our imaginations that, well, why would I want to be on the side of a terrorist, right? That people can't even, as I've talked about this topic with people over the last couple of years, when you introduced the issue, that people don't even have a structure for thinking about.
Right.
Why would, if they're terrorists, why would I be supporting them, right? You know, that's a big hurdle for an awful lot of people to get over, which I know as we talk, you're going to say was even one of the issues with the jury. So Bruhan, can you paint a little bit of a picture for who these guys are? And as you see it, what happened? And as somebody who's part of the Somali community, how people in the Somali community experience a story like this and the unfolding actions of this so differently than those of us who are just paying attention from the news?
These young men, and I don't want to feel like I'm speaking for them personally. I don't have that type of relationship with them individual persons. But, talking about it from a perspective of the communities that they come from, you're talking about a community that's marginalized politically, economically, and so when there's this opportunity for people to really hear and to really see through the information that's being fed to them through the media, through the federal government and these charges, people honestly just take these things at face value. I mean, again, those are very harsh charges, and so to the average person, to the average listener, they're thinking, they must have did something. And so, but then again, when you honestly look at the communities that they come from and the people that they were, I mean, a lot of these young men, they were working, they're going to school. They're living, the life of any person in this country, and trying to provide for their families, and the overcharging and exaggeration of of painting not only them as terrorists and people who somehow posed an immediate threat to the safety of this country, is something that I think it was perfectly put together by the federal government, because again, you're talking about a community that's very marginalized and isolated, and so the routes or the avenues for us to really speak up and be heard are not there, and so all you're hearing is the charges, and again, these young men were living normal lives, and If anything, you know, they deserved a second chance. You know, you're talking about a young man that never committed a crime, never touched a firearm, you know, and so when you have these facts in place and you still get 30 years for someone who's a first-time offender and, you know, being charged with these type of offenses, that really speaks to how political it is. You know, it wasn't, you know, like I said, they didn't pose any immediate threat to the communities they come from, you know, and to this country. And so, you know, the community, because of that lack of support in the way, you know, that's what we're dealing with, you know, young men that are fighting for their lives.
Yeah, and part of what makes this so complicated is there's all these interlacing issues. And this is true in any issues of justice, any of us who work in criminal justice reform, you begin to realize how much racism, poverty, police overcharging, sentencing, all get sort of mixed together into a concoction that you almost can't pull apart, right? Because it becomes very difficult to understand these kinds of issues. And then you mix in it the idea that most Minnesotans see themselves as sort of law-abiding citizens. And if you were a law-abiding citizen, you probably wouldn't get yourself arrested. It's one of the myths that flows around, especially white dominant communities, is we tend to think, well, I don't get arrested for things because I don't do things. People who get arrested are those who do things. And this case, even though it has terrorism and national security charges related to it, really has this whole sense to it. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about how did all this happen? How does it happen in Minnesota? And what can people who care about progressive values, how can we engage in this together? So we'll be back with Matt Palumbo and Burhan here after the break on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens is the first green cemetery in Minnesota. It's a beautiful, peaceful place where burials are celebrations of life with as little impact on the environment as possible. Tony Weber founded it because he wants to leave a green legacy for his grandchildren, something many of us might feel. Learn more, visit the website mngreengraves.com. Give them a call. The goal is so meaningful, so positive, it might be right for you. Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens.
Hi, this is Laura Hedlund with Food Freedom Radio. This Saturday, we're going to be talking about the food system. Do we have a kind and sane food system? Nitrates in the water, climate change, injustice, chronic diseases up. How do we change that food system to something that's kinder and more rational? We'll be talking with Alyssa Banks from the United Way. We're also going to be talking with Green Garden Bakery. That's a youth-run business in North Minneapolis selling vegetable-based desserts. Get it? Vegetable-based desserts? How fun. So tune to us. Food Freedom Radio, Saturdays at 8 a.m.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is all digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Visit the wine bar at Cafe Latte and enjoy a unique handcrafted pizza and glass of wine. The perfect place for an intimate night or an evening with friends. Choices range from spicy Italian sausage and sweet roasted peppers to the one-of-a-kind nacho chicken pizza layered with blue corn tortilla chips. The approachable wine list offers over 30 by the glass, with special emphasis on wines from Washington State. End your night with one of Cafe Latte's melt-in-your-mouth desserts, 850 Grand Avenue, St. Paul.
Hey, Minnesota, Norman Goldman here. Catch me live every weeknight from 5 to 8 p.m. right here on AM 950. Whether it's a recap of the day's news, legal analysis, or teaching civics, justice is always served on the Norman Goldman Show. Today on the show, it's the day of the big summit and everybody's all excited, except I'm not all excited because the whole thing may fizzle into a giant nothing. A lot of pageantry? Substance? Join me every weeknight from 5 to 8 on AM 950.
Tap, taste, and treasure at Vinaigrette, where we have some warm seasonal recipes all ready to create dynamite meals. Our fig balsamic vinegar pairs perfectly with roasted Brussels sprouts or baked brie. And sweet potatoes are always a winner, but never more than when they're roasted with a drizzle of vinaigrette cinnamon or orange-fused extra virgin olive oil on top. Come in today for more custom-crafted food and cocktail recipes at Vinaigrette, 50th and Xerxes in Minneapolis and 287 Water Street in downtown Excelsior. Online at vinaigrettemn.com.
Welcome back, AM 950, Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Doug Padgett, filling in today on Drive Time, and I'm here in the studio with Matthew Palumbo and with Bruham. Matthew is a professor of philosophy, so at some point in the hour, I want to talk to you about how you got involved in all of this. And Brian, you're an activist that participates inside the Somali community to try to raise issues of awareness and justice across the entire landscape of what it means to be a person living here in Minnesota. So the story in Minnesota is that if you read the news headlines 4 or 5 years ago, the police did their job, the FBI did their job, terrorists were found, they were convicted and moved on. That was sort of the level of inquiry for a lot of us who just paid attention to the headlines on the news, and some of us acted shocked that there was, we didn't know something like that was going on. And like all good stories and like all documentaries, which you all are part of working on for this, there's a whole lot more to this story, and it shows some of the issues that continue to show up in our society. Issues of criminal justice, issues of the police, issues of marginalized communities. So, Burhan, can you give a picture of what was going on with these young men and how it turned up that a whole group of them were approached by the FBI, some turned into informants, and others charged with crimes against the United States and turned into terrorism charges? How did this all come about? And what do you really think the back part of the story is that a lot of us need to know about?
I think, you know, when you're dealing with a very vulnerable community, people don't realize how much room that gives, body of the government to infiltrate and to violate that community. I mean, you know, again, you're talking about, you know, any laws that you would think would protect anyone in this country are literally violated. You're talking about people coming into your home, people tailgating you, and setting up informants within the community. And with these specific individuals, you know, some of them were being followed for years. Are you talking about when they were probably 15, 16, I mean, even younger than that, by federal agents, by the police in this state? And so, just to have people, you know, being in those shoes of having somebody literally after you and following you, you know, that would break down anyone, honestly. And especially when you're somebody who is politically conscious and you sympathize with what's happening around the world. And, you know, that can be, in a way, used against you. And now you're talking about, you know, people that haven't did anything. It's literally, it's a conspiracy. You know?
Yeah, so, and this can all sound to people like it's really fanciful. But right. I'm the pastor of a church, and our church used to be over on 13th Avenue and 28th Street in Southwest Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. The building is now a mosque. Okay, yep. And there was a somebody got arrested in our back parking lot. Just a particular thing was happening. I don't know what it was. I came out of the building and saw it happening. And out of nowhere, this isn't like 2004, out of nowhere, half a dozen cars come screeching into the parking lot, and jumping out of it are guys pulling badges that say FBI over their coats. And all of a sudden, the parking lot is full of 6 or 8 FBI agents, just appeared out of nowhere. I had no idea that in South Minneapolis, just sort of moving around unmarked, were all these FBI agents. And when I mentioned some of that to the Somali community leaders who live there, they said, oh, we know that's going on. They're very aware of the fact that there's patrols and there's FBI agents. That's a really curious thing for progressively minded people in this state to have to recognize that there are different lived experiences amongst different communities when it comes to law enforcement. And it's really upsetting to when you are the one who's being approached and watched, right? That's part of the power. And that's part of what the FBI tends to do, don't they? Like, they show up in your life and they show up in places that tends to rattle young men. Now Matt, you were saying that this has been going on since 1999, 2000, 2001.
That's right.
Here in Minnesota?
That's right. The Somali community has been under surveillance and targeted for terrorism since 1999. That amplified after 9/11. This included undercover agents in mosques, targeting of people, shutting down banks and businesses. I mean, virtually the entire community was targeted and under FBI activity beginning in 1999 and continuing today. I've been teaching 15 years at Minneapolis Community Technical College. Every semester, Somali students have told me and given me personal stories of being targeted, surveyed, subpoenaed by the FBI since I began teaching there in 2003. It has been 20 years. So when these young men are growing up, they're growing up in a community that's not just marginalized, but is targeted by the FBI and in some ways terrorized and made into a terrorist community long before anybody is even connected to that. So people often get it backwards. They think, well, it's the community's fault because there are a few quote-unquote bad apples that gave this stigma. It's actually the reverse. Is the FBI and our government made this community stigmatized with terrorism beginning in 1999 and continuing on to today.
Now where this connects to those who follow current day politics is that when we hear things like the Trump administration saying things like this, or a guy named Roger Stone, if you follow politics very closely, saying, look, once the FBI gets their hooks into you, they're going to turn you into a criminal no matter what. And a lot of us hear that and just think, no, that's not how it goes. They only catch the criminals. And you guys are telling a different story about that here in Minnesota, that these young men. And I know you're sympathetic and other people will have different views. I'm sure the prosecutors and the jury will have concluded much differently about this. And without there's an appeals trial on Thursday where they will have a day in court and some of the arguments about the validity of their conviction will be front and center. But there's a bigger issue than only their conviction. And that's something that you're wanting to raise in raising the situation of these young men is the way that they're treated and the way that we organize in this state and what it means for us to be the kinds of people that Minnesotans want to be. This is one of the biggest arrests and prosecutions of terrorists in the United States.
That's right. The trial and conviction was the largest counterterrorism case in U.S. history, and the Somali community has been the largest. The United States has put the most force on this community than anywhere else in the United States. And it's intimately tied to U.S. imperial activities in Somalia as well. When the United States went into Somalia in 2002 and has been there and created more problems than helped, that paralleled the targeting of the Somali community here. So there's an intimate relationship between U.S. imperial practices in Somalia and U.S., in many ways, imperial or colonial practices against the Somali community here. Those are directly related.
So you're suggesting that the foreign policy of the United States,
that's right,
toward a nation in Africa, it means that that has played out in people who are legal citizens living in this country,
exactly,
and want to live here as refugees and as full members of our country and of
that's
this
right.
society.
That's right.
I mean, this is the kind of thing, honestly, I mean, it's destabilizing, right? I'm sure when people hear it, as I first did, it almost seems impossible to believe, right? You want to say to yourself, no, there's got to be protections that keep this from happening. There's no way it can be unfolding like this. They don't do this to innocent people. Why would they do such a thing?
Well, it's true. There are protections, but when people hear terrorism, they tend to throw those all out the window.
Interesting. Let's talk about that when we come back here after the break. What happens when these trigger words fire somebody's sensibilities and all caution is cast to the wind? AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Heavy topic at drive time.
This is Chad, owner of AM 950, here to tell you about Snap Construction. They're experts in roofing, siding, window, and insurance restoration. They have energy-efficient products available for both residential and commercial properties. This spring, when we needed a company to take a look at a problem with our roof, I called the company I knew I could trust, Snap Construction. I've known Ryan, the owner at Snap Construction, for years, so I knew I could trust him. Don't just take my word for it. Check out their reviews online. They are arguably the most well-reviewed exterior contractor online in the metro area. Over the years, Ryan has always said the same thing to me about his work. If we build it, shouldn't we be held accountable for the work indefinitely? He backed that statement up years ago when Snap Construction was a pioneer in offering a lifetime craftsmanship guarantee on all their work. For a free estimate or general questions, call the locally owned company AM 950 Trusts, Snap Construction, at 612-333-SNAP. That's 612-333-SNAP, or find them online at snapconstruction.com. They have financing options available.
Crazy about pets? We are too. The Pet Connection Show is a great venue for fun, informative, and creative conversations about pets. Join myself, Kathy Menard, and Dr. Nicole Parole, along with guests who are leaders in the dynamic and growing pet industry, as we discuss healthcare, relationships, behaviors, and even political issues as they relate to our pets. So come, sit, stay for the Pet Connection Show, Sundays 11 a.m. to noon on AM 950 Radio, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Oh no, you shattered your cell phone. Now what? Listen closely. We know you're lost without your phone. Bring it to Computer Revolution today. We'll fix it and have you back online before someone asks, "Where are you?" Computer Revolution with Cell Phone Repair has over 18 years experience fixing computer devices, all brands, all carriers. Computer Revolution with Cell Phone Repair, located in Roseville at Highway 36 and Fairview Avenue, or call 651-633-6600. We fix phones, same day, 7 days a week.
As with their Eat Street sister on Nicollet Avenue, the Bad Waitress at 700 Central and Northeast is committed to working with local purveyors and serving organic food whenever possible. But the Northeast location is a bit more grown up. This finer diner has a full bar serving craft cocktails and a brand new inventive dinner menu, including the chicken and waffle with roasted half chicken, bourbon pickled jalapeno corn waffle, and a roasted poblano gravy. Check out the Northeast menu at thebadwaitress.com.
It's a good day to be indigenous.
Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake. Our weekly Native American talk radio show will discuss national and local Native American news and events. Local and national guests will help us keep current with Mother Earth, tribal, and Twin City issues. Native American issues are human issues. We invite all people to walk hand in hand with our struggles, victories, and achievements. Listen Saturdays at 2 p.m.
I am awake.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Brett Johnson. Look for partly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 56. Wednesday sunny with a high near 80. Thursday partly sunny with a high near 81. And Friday showers and storms with a high around 86. Nokomis Cycle is the hardest working bike shop in town. They're celebrating their 23rd year in business, and in that time they've mastered the art of friendly, dependable service. So keep life and your bike moving at Nokomis Cycle, located off 46th and Bloomington Avenue South in Minneapolis, or at nokomiscycle.com.
AM 950, Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Doug Padgett filling in and bringing a heavy topic here on my first fill-in day. Remembering and asking people who care to think about one of the biggest cases in terrorism history and one of the biggest criminal justice issues. The arrest of 10 Somali men, the convictions of three of them, given 30 and 35 years in prison. Young men, and they're 19 and 20 years old, sent to prison here in Minnesota 3-4 years ago, 2015, and then sentenced in 2016. It's a major story that a lot of us have lost track of, but it's important. And part of the reason we're talking about it today is that on Thursday there's a trial for
an appeal trial.
That's right. And an appeal hearing. And if people are interested, we'd like to invite them down to the courthouse. What courthouse are they going to be at, Matt?
It's a U.S. Court of Appeals in downtown St. Paul. There's a Minnesota Court of Appeals and a U.S. Court of Appeals. So it's the U.S. Court of Appeals, Robert Street, 8 a.m. is the rally, 9 a.m. is the appeal.
And a lot of people haven't been invited to a rally to support men who were convicted on terrorism charges. And that's part of the power of a terrorism charge, is that in our current society, it just is a trigger that stops almost all other conversation and makes people nervous. Makes me nervous talking about it here on the radio, right? You start to say to yourself, what if these guys aren't terrorists, then what are they, right? How does this happen? So as you think about this, how do you describe, Burhan or Matt, how do you describe the plight of these guys? If they were convicted as terrorists and you're wanting people to say there's another part of this story that you haven't heard, how do you describe their condition? Who are they?
Well, I would, a lot of these young men were students at MCTC, where I teach. And in 2013, early 2014, they became aware of the atrocities happening in Syria. They saw Bashar al-Assad murder and rape and kill and gas millions of people, right? And they were moved out of empathy to help. victims. It had nothing to do with an extremist ideology. It had nothing to do with radicalization. They were simply moved out of compassion to help.
So these guys are late teenagers.
They're late teenagers.
They're seeing the news.
That's right. And they're like, we want to help. It's a very human response to be able to help victims in Syria. And in early 2014, remember, this is before ISIS was declared a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. This is before ISIS-related violence was happening at all in the United States or in Europe.
There were resistance groups inside of Syria.
That's right. They were fighting Bashar al-Assad. Mm-hmm. They were not a terrorist organization at that point. And so these young men, because, as Burhan has talked about, because of the marginalization, because of the stigmatization, they started talking in private about going over and helping. And in many ways built up ISIS in their own minds that was not necessarily connected to the reality of what was going on. But when you are part of a marginalized community, you can't talk about this openly. You know, when teachers in Minnesota are encouraged to report young Muslim men, if they say certain words or do certain things, report their names to the FBI.
Is that true?
That's absolutely true.
That's a thing that happens?
This is absolutely true in the Minneapolis public school systems and in colleges. They are encouraged and funded to do counterterrorism work. So that teachers are trained.
Really?
And given these are the signatures, these are the stairs. So imagine you're a young person and you care about these things. You can't talk about this in public. You can't have an open conversation about this. So they were forced into simply talking about these things in private, in social media. And in that context of them talking privately, remember, none had a criminal record. They'd never left the country. They never committed violence. There was no plan to do any violence. They were talking about this in private. And that's when the FBI paid an informant to go in and record and encourage them to join ISIS. And during conversations, they recorded some of the things that they were saying out of context and used that as evidence in the trial against them. Most of them, even in the conversation about leaving, had decided not to leave. It was a very brief, less than a year conversation. Now, if that was going on in any other community, the FBI would not be sending in informants. Hmm. But this community was already targeted. That was already standard practice. And all of the evidence and all of what was against them came from the informants and some of those who
now, Matt, Matthew, you've taken a great interest in this, partly because you know these boys, you know their families, you know their plight. You were at the trial. You paid attention. I'm sure these arguments were made there, right? And I'm sure the documentary that you all are working on, I hope is out someday, will tell these stories. Why was that argument that you've made there not accepted by the jury and by the prosecutors, that these were young men who, just like Jewish religious communities want to care for people in Israel and Palestine and Christians want to help around the world, that Muslims want to help in a place where there's Muslims who are suffering, and that's all they were wanting to do was to care? How was that recast?
That argument was made by the defense lawyers, but the difficulty is that after these young men were arrested and incarcerated, ISIS and ISIS-related violence escalated, and it escalated a lot in the United States. And so what the jury was shown primarily is gruesome, horrific ISIS videos of people being beheaded, right? Talking about ISIS homegrown terrorism in the country. And so there was all of this fear. The whole framework was around terrorism. And you already had some of the young men forced to plead guilty. And so in many ways, these young men had no chance at a fair trial. And in my opinion, the jury never really got to see who these young men are in their character and in their lives at all.
Burhan, you know these men, you know their families and their communities. This impulse to want to help, for that to then be diverted into being some sort of an act of aggression against the United States, to a lot of us that seems just impossible to understand. How does that land on you? How do you understand that shift? Does that seem like that's just par for the course? That's the kind of thing that happens? That's misunderstanding mm-hmm. between a Somali community experience of life and non-Somalian?
I personally think it's a very human, reaction to, especially when you identify with a group of people and you identify with that type of struggle. Because a lot of us, obviously, we're coming from from a place where we saw our parents and people in our community witness, those same atrocities that's taking place in Syria. And so some of these young men, I always try to give people an example of if you saw a house burning to the ground and you saw people in that house, if there's three of us, one of us, by some weird inclination you might, think up, they run into the house. And all of a sudden you're thinking, like, why did that person run into the house? And so rather than somebody saying, wow, they were deeply, they had a deep empathy and they were sympathetic to what's happening, that they would risk their own well-being to help. And rather than, those young men being given that chance and the public to see them in that light, they were characterized and labeled as, wanting to be part of a monstrous organization that just wanted to, wreak havoc on people.
Like they were called terror. They were called arsonists.
Right.
Yeah, for burning the house down.
There you go. And a lot of the ways that people receive what's been happening in the state and around the country by anyone who's charged with a terrorist crime is that, wow, they wanted to just, they wanted to kill people for no reason. And they just wanted to, commit these acts of violence. And so I think a lot of that responsibility, honestly goes to the way the media portrays what's happening. And so when the federal government is indicting these men on these charges and you read in the newspaper, you're listening to the news and you're hearing ISIS, 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 and you're not really given any chance to empathize with what's happening in Syria, and you're given this one, picture where it just literally thwarts your way of thinking about what's happening there. And now you're focused in on these young men that now you feel like, wow, they were terrorists. Not being given the opportunity to think like, wait a minute, maybe they wanted to really go down there and help. And that was really robbed, I think. People were robbed of that narrative by the media specifically. And anyone who's followed the story and who's not part of the community, I don't really blame them for taking it the way they would, which is like, wow, we were saved, and that's really unfortunate, so.
Well, that's one of the questions I had for you guys is that there's been no media coverage of this suggesting that these men were treated unfairly, that they were affected by overcharging or by an FBI agenda. And it's a little easier for some of us who are progressively minded to watch the media and journalists not do investigative reporting when you watch the election of Donald Trump, right? So I will, that's a fresh thing that affects a lot of our lives where we're like, hey, someone should have been paying attention, or how we got into the Gulf War was not reported in a way that now people have come to understand. You're convinced that there was no investigative journalistic approach bringing a critique to these arrests and the prosecutions, that it was pretty much passed along. And because it was a marginalized community of Somali peoples, there was nobody advocating on their behalf because of cultural differences, language differences, and just fear. Who wants to be on the wrong side of a terrorism argument?
Absolutely.
This is one of the reasons why we're putting together a documentary to reveal this and to give people an opportunity to hear this narrative of what's going on. I was talked to with countless international media. One of the problems is that a lot of journalists come in and they have a certain understanding of terrorists already, and they're just applying that to these young men. So, I know about terrorists elsewhere, and they just applied it. So a lot of the journalists didn't have an openness to these young men. Even some of the local journalists, many of whom are not part of the Somali community and don't have good relationships with the Somali community, even there, it was over-determined by what the journalists already had in their head and not listening to the young men and their families and the community themselves.
Yeah, there was zero effort in trying to come at this from an investigative journalism point of view, which is, they were literally writing these stories as the federal government was giving it to them. Like, these are the charges, this is ISIS. And so all of it was literally written within the context of the war on terror. I mean, you can imagine, during the height of the war on drugs, any story that, especially that's when the conspiracy laws were really picking up in a way. And so anyone that was charged with the conspiracy to distribute drugs, they weren't given any chance to really, you know, tell the story any other way. It was just you tell it within the context of the war on drugs, within the context of the war on terror. And so when that happens, there is no effort to really investigate the charges, to investigate these conspiracy laws that destroy communities and that destroy families. It was literally, you know, you dub people, you know, within this context as terrorists. And then, you know, the journalists, the editors, you know, you're talking about every major media, local media in this state. And there wasn't any effort to give another perspective. And, you know, and that's just, like I said, that's unfortunate.
Well, let's take some calls if people are interested. Maybe, I'm not sure people want to call in and talk about this. Some people don't even want to be on the record at all about topics like this. But 952-946-6205. Give us a call. You can talk to Burhan, you can talk to Matthew, or you can ask me, or share your opinion about a topic that seems so poignant and scary and sad in some ways and doesn't seem very Minnesotan, frankly.
I'm Steve Conklin.
And I'm Jake DeRoff.
We're the hosts of the Mortgage Talk Show, Sundays at 12:30.
Every week, we bring you insights on home financing, discussing rates, programs, local and national news.
Whether you're buying your first home or your 100th home, we have tips and inside information to save you money and feel like a mortgage master.
Check us out for more information and email us any questions at mortgagetalkshow.com.
Tune in to the Mortgage Talk Show every Sunday at 12:30 on AM 950.
It's a great day for a bike ride. What's that? You can't find your bike? Oh, it has a flat. No problem. Take it to Nokomis Cycle, the hardest working bike shop in town. They're celebrating their 23rd year in business. In that time, they've mastered the art of friendly, dependable service. So keep life and your bike moving with Nokomis Cycle, working harder to make you go faster. Nokomis Cycle at the corner of 46th and Bloomington Avenue South in Minneapolis or at nokomiscycle.com.
Do yourself a favor and check out the amazing cuisine of eatlocalminnesota.com. More than just a website, eatlocalminnesota.com provides you with the best local and independently owned restaurants in the Twin Cities. The award-winning Hazel's Northeast combines the feel of a small-town diner with the vibrant nature of its Northeast Minneapolis neighborhood. Whether it's breakfast, lunch, weekend brunch, or dinner, their classically inspired and creatively prepared American comfort food is always made from scratch. Hazel's Northeast at 29th and Johnson in Northeast Minneapolis. EatLocalMinnesota.com. The dedicated staff at Nightingale Restaurant take pride in presenting a thoughtful and delicious approach to food and drink, whether you're visiting for dinner, happy hour, or brunch. Their focus on made-from-scratch meals using sustainable and local ingredients is likely to make Nightingale your go-to spot for inspired food and drinks. Nightingale, Lindell and 26th in Minneapolis.
Are you trying to live stream on Facebook, on YouTube? Tired of no one watching your videos? Well, whether you're a beginner or a veteran, you can have better results. Hi, it's Mike McEntee with The Uptake. We're famous for our live streaming of thousands of events that are watched by millions. I want to help you live stream video like a pro for your cause, your group, or your company. I'm teaching a class on June 9th where you'll learn how to use your phone or professional camera to deliver the best live experience for your audience. I'll teach you how to attract an audience and how to keep reaching that audience when you're no longer live. Find out what platform works best for what you're trying to do. Sign up now at theuptake.org/classes. Space is limited. Go to theuptake.org/classes to sign up for this June 9th class. There's a $70 charge, but there's a discount for students and low-income people. That's theuptake.org/classes to learn how to live stream like a pro.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Doug Padgett, filling in today, tomorrow, and the next day. We'll talk a little politics tomorrow and the next day, but today we're talking about politics in a slightly different way. A little biography. I do a couple things in my life. I'm a religious pastor and leader, but I'm also an activist. In the last few years, I've become an activist around criminal justice issues, capital punishment, anti-gun legislation kind of things. And so I get arrested intentionally in order to arrest the attention of the public. And it's been a very curious thing as someone who gets arrested as a political act to be, because my friends ask me and family and other people, they're like, why are you getting arrested? Like, why not be law abiding? And there are times where one feels the need to use the political force of the law in order to critique the law. Sometimes the only way you get on the right side of an issue is to be on the wrong side of the law. And that's a bit of a mind bend for some people, right? A lot of us have been taught to be conformers in society and to keep up. And during the break here, we were talking that about that question earlier. If you don't call these young men who were arrested here in Minnesota a number of years ago on terrorism charges, if you don't call them terrorists, what do you call them? And when you were mentioning, Matthew, that tomorrow or on Thursday at 8 a.m. at the St. Paul U.S. Appeals Court, you asked people to wear orange when they show up for this rally, and then the appeals hearing will be at 9 a.m. So at 8 a.m. to show up with orange. What will you talk about why they are being asked to wear orange?
So we believe that these young men are political prisoners. There are a lot of hundreds and thousands of Muslim people in this country and around the world have been swept up in the tow of the war on terror. Many, many more black communities have been swept into the war on drugs. And anytime anybody is imprisoned for no criminal activity, no violence, but for political matters, we consider them, and Amnesty and others consider them, political prisoners. So we are wearing orange Thursday morning, 8 a.m., in solidarity with all political prisoners in the United States and in the world. And that is, we believe these young men are there because they have been targeted and the political interests of the United States.
And some of this rests on the very facts of the case, is your argument, that your argument is they didn't actually do anything. They were convicted for their intent, not for their actions. They're being convicted for their opinions that they conveyed to another person about what they thought was important. And you're putting that those actions that the government determined to be anti-American and or terrorism activities, way to understand that is as
That's right. If the United States was not militarily involved in Somalia since 2001, and even before that, if the United States was not targeting and marginalizing and preying on the Somali community, these young men talking privately about empathy for victims in Syria, talking about ISIS in an open way, that would have been, they would not have been preyed on, they would not have been in prison today.
Well, when you make this argument to people on the other side, who think differently about this topic, what do they say back? When you say, I think they're political prisoners, what's the response that you so often hear from people?
Most people don't know much about the case. Right. Communities that are very familiar with the long history of FBI targeting of black communities, if people are familiar with mass incarceration, if they're familiar with being a victim of police brutality, they get this. They sadly understand the reality of these young men now experiencing what black communities have experienced for a long time in this country. And so they get it. For other communities that are not aware of that history and those dynamics, it can be a bit of a shock. Mm-hmm. But most everybody that we talk to, when we talk about young men, young teenagers talking about having empathy, they very much understand it. And most people do not come back and say, oh, I think they should be in prison. I think they should be in prison for the rest of their lives. We have not received that for people who are aware and understand the full facts of the case, the mass incarceration laws used against them, many of which are unjust.
And that date back to the 1990s and the—
That's right. The laws that these young men were convicted on were part of the Omnibus Violent Criminal Act in 1994. They were increased in 96. And the Patriot Act ramped up a lot of these as well. And so the exact same laws used in the mass incarceration in the war on drugs are now being used in the war on terror, and particularly here against the Somali community and Muslim community.
Burhan, when we were talking earlier today, you had said that part of the reason you do this is you want to use whatever privilege you have on behalf of those who don't have that kind of privilege, which I think is a really interesting invitation to people who are listening to this, that they could be invited to use the privilege they have on behalf of someone else. That can feel unsettling for people to consider that. But can you talk a bit about how you view your own sense of privilege and why you would use what you have to be supportive of issues that people don't care about?
And for me personally, I grew up in this country. I'm a naturalized citizen of this country, and I was also fortunate enough to be politically to be around a group of politically conscious folks that allowed me to understand the world, you know, in a whole different reality. Hmm. And from there on, I felt like it was my own, you know, it was my calling. It was a duty of mine to really be able to use my voice and to risk whatever privileges that I had, you know, to be able to say something when I know something is wrong, you know, especially in this case where people, you know, because again, it's I think for anyone who's not aware of what's happening, you know, when you study the laws that they were convicted under, you know, and how these laws, again, you know, anytime you study them, that these laws are for the sole purpose of advancing the political interests of the United States, of any Western government that's really involved in the global South, honestly. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that, you know, it's you have Somali young men coming from a country and that the United States has been associated with for decades, you know, even when we had a government in Somalia, and the fact that these young men are being, you know, being sentenced under these harsh laws under the guise of, you know, the war on terror, I think anyone who studies that and looks into it will see that it's something that I think will honestly have people, at least it will allow them to be more, to have a sense of conscience, you know, where they're like, wait a minute, this is absolutely wrong. And that's where I honestly come in and try to speak up whenever I can about issues like this.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I've been thinking about this issue, Matthew, since you introduced it to me. And this political time that we live in, a lot of us feel like we're living in one of those ages that feels like a time of clarity. I feel like you can see this with our current president, with the administration. Like, this is a time where there are things going on in this country that just have to be responded to. And in 20 and 30 and 40 years, we're going to look back on this time and say it was really clear. This issue that may feel murky right now feels to me like it's the kind of issue we're going to look back on two or three or four decades and say things like, can you believe we did that? Because there's been other times in our history where this country has turned a blind eye to the oppression of a subset of people for our own security. And now it seems like, how could we have let that happen? And we might be in the middle of one of those right now.
And let's hope that these young men are out of prison when we reflect decades on this, rather than people who realize this and they're in prison when we realize that these horrible things we've done in the past.
So anyway, if you want to be part of this, down in St. Paul, 8 a.m. on Thursday at the United States Court of Appeals. And this is AM 950. I'm Doug Padgett. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll talk a little politics and what we can do about the other parts of our government to make the more beautiful world that we want to live in. Thanks for being with us today.